Great Britain colleagues who have really come a very long way. We're very grateful for them. Our next speaker is Heward Wilkinson, and one of the most distinguished thinkers and writers and speakers on the topics. His emails and discourses are at a level that we all have to pay very close attention. So please come in and sit down, make yourself comfortable, turn off your cell phones. I do still have two tickets for Much Ado About Nothing, and these are donations from Robert Trechter, who cannot go to the show tonight. So if any of you don't have a ticket to Much Ado and you want to go to the show, please see me right after the conclusion of the session this afternoon. We're going to go continuously between now and the end of the afternoon. So, bear with us. And immediately after the conclusion of the session at 5:30, we will have the opening reception right here in the garden and in the area immediately adjacent to here. There's a no-host wine bar. Unless you buy a certain amount of wine, the SOF gets charged quite a bit. So drink hardy, my friend. You go on more than once, I understand. So drink heartily today. We'll be back tomorrow and more. So this is your one opportunity to really celebrate the occasion of arrival here and joining your colleagues. And for those of you sitting in the far back where the sound system is not so good, please, speakers, speak into the microphone so the people in the back can hear. And those of you who ask questions, speak very loudly so that everyone can hear the questions. When you don't speak loudly, it's not so good. Yes, Richard.
If somebody asks a question from the front of the room, have the speaker repeat it.
The speakers are being asked now to repeat the questions if it's not heard by everybody. But some people know how to speak up when they ask their questions. So please speak loudly so that we can do this. Yes, James. We only have two microphones, so I'll have to circulate out to the audience to do that, and it's kind of a scattered crowd. We should do it like an academic presentation where the questioners have to come forward to a microphone. Okay, so from now on, henceforth, if you have a question, come forward to the stage left, and you will have access to the mic, and if you want to ask a question, you must come forward. So if you want, you have to get up and come along. Okay, without further ado, our colleague Heward Wilkinson.
Do you all hear me?
Yes.
Sorry, I didn't hear that. Now, what's this all about? I'm going to reveal it to you, but first, this is very serious. I have to make a confession. My name is Heward Wilkinson. And I am an oxaholic. And this takes many forms and is very difficult to root out. It sends down deep tendrils into the depths of the soul and grips one in a horrific way. For example, before I came here, I was participating in some psychotherapy work in Toronto, and I had two colleagues who very kindly allowed me to regale them with a trial run of this talk. It's deteriorated since then, but well, as is the case with people who are not familiar with the question, I had to do some explaining. And that explaining takes the form of adducing all the things that make it problematic that William of Stratford wrote the plays, on the one hand, and then one gets enticed into, on the other hand, explaining why it's rather plausible that the Earl of Oxford did write the plays, or at least the bulk of them. And everyone, I would imagine, who is familiar with the issues and is in some sense not a Stratfordian, has experienced this. You don't want to override people's skepticism. You want to be reasonable. You don't want to convert. But deep down inside you, you know that one more drink will take you back, and therefore you have to protect them by converting them. By converting them. And in trying to convert them, one uses factual information. One uses... Can you hear it?
Yeah. You were too loud. I didn't hear you down.
Never too loud.
This is the first time I've been turned down in my life. So, what was I saying? So, one gets caught up in telling the factual story. And then we wonder why our Stratfordian opponents aren't interested. See, there are addictions and there are counter-addictions. The manifestation of the counter-addiction on the Stratfordian side is the progressive vanishing of the Earl of Oxford and everything associated with him. It runs rather parallel to those who think that, and I'm one of them, the Kennedy assassination produced as one of the reactions against it the modern conception of conspiracy theory. Because of course there are conspiracies out there, but you'd never believe that there were to hear modern people talk about conspiracy theory. They use it in a way that always means it's delusional. I think that's a reaction to the extreme peculiarities of the data in relation to the Kennedy assassination, because it didn't have that meaning before. Now, likewise, the vanishing of the evidence for the Earl of Oxford is one of the manifestations. We were talking about it last night at Earl's. And, for example, in the 19th century, Sir Sidney Lee wrote the Dictionary of National Biography entry for the Earl of Oxford, and he also referred favourably to Oxford's poetry. And John Thomas Loney used that entry as one of his clues that led him in the direction of the Earl of Oxford. But in 1920, the Earl of Oxford became radioactive. And as a result of that, a huge wall, rather like the one Mr. Trump is going to build, a huge wall has been built around the Earl of Oxford, so that it's no longer possible for any but the most well-disposed Stratfordians to talk about this. So, if I may say so, madness on both sides. Now I'm going to come to the two positions in Hamlet, because Hamlet characteristically takes up all the positions in his different processes. Now this is what I'm going to come back to. You all know this. And in very short order, I'm going to say that there's been a strong tendency amongst Oxfordianism to talk as if what Hamlet wrote, or rather what Shakespeare wrote as Hamlet saying, was to hold the mirror up to nature, not to hold, as 'twere, the mirror up to nature. So, now then, hang on a sec, I need data, where have I put it? Okay, I'll improvise. In the speech after the players have first appeared, Hamlet starts out with, what's he to Hecuba and Hecuba to him? And at the end he says, the play is the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. Now, Oxfordians always concentrate on the latter. We might say that Stratfordians concentrate on the former. What's he to Hecuba and Hecuba to him? What would he say had he the motive and the cue for passion that I have? He would drown the stage with tears, etc. If you left it as what's he to Hecuba and Hecuba to him, then you have what increasingly became the Stratfordian position. Because this positivism, and I think philosophically it is positivism on both sides, goes in two different directions. In the preface to the picture of Dorian Gray, Oscar Wilde ends his preface with the remark, "All art is quite useless." That was his popular version of the art for art's sake position. But it continued. In 1920 or 21, I can't remember exactly when, T.S. Eliot wrote Tradition and the Individual Talent. Again, I don't know if I've got my sheet, but I have this. No, I haven't. Okay. Anyway, roughly speaking, Eliot, he compares the artistic process to the catalyst of a chemical reaction by a filament of platinum. And he says, the mind of the artist is the piece of platinum. The greater the artist, the more completely separate in him is the man who suffers from the artist who creates. This is another variant on the art for art's sake position. And then, and I can't quote them now because I haven't got my piece of paper. Oh, my tablets, where are my tablets? Yeah. Anyway, Winsett and Beardsley, in the first essay in the Verbal Icon, entitled The Intentional Fallacy, completely repudiate the idea of biographical relevance. They say what you are doing in thinking about literature is you are considering the work of art as a complete and self-contained entity. You can talk about the intentionality of the characters, you can't talk about the intentionality of the artist. It's not relevant. We do not need, the article ends, to consult the oracle.
This is in 1920?
No, this is much later. This is sort of 50s. I can't remember exactly when the Verbal Icon came out. Did it come out by 1960 or so when I was studying English? And then finally, of course, James Shapiro, Professor Shapiro, takes up this position in Contested Will. The final words of Contested Will are something like, again I can't remember it precisely, does the artist need to replace the airy nothing to which the artist gives a local habitation and a name? This is Theseus's very positivistic speech in Act 5 of The Midsummer Night's Dream, which we all know. Or does the airy nothing have to become a disguised something which relates to biographical detail about the life of the author? So he's taking up the same position. He says it's a profound and consequential choice. And it's clear which way he goes on it. Now, we have two different belief systems here. I believe they are both positivistic belief systems as they stand. That's not to say that people can't take up elements of positions that are much more profound, as it were, despite their official position. One of the great Shakespearean critics, Wilson Knight, George Wilson Knight, in the early parts of his book, The Wheel of Fire, which I think is one of the supreme pieces of Shakespeare criticism of the 20th century, he makes it clear that he too takes up this anti-biographical position. And yet, in the postscript to his book, when he has an essay on Second Thoughts on Hamlet, he discusses Hamlet in terms which imply that he considers Hamlet a person who is wrestling with the real issues that all of us are wrestling with as to the fundamental stances we should take up in life. And he notes that Hamlet, in doing so, draws extensively on Cortegione, Il Cortegione, the courtier, the book of the courtier. Therefore, Wilson Knight takes another position than his official one. Likewise, in another very great piece of Shakespeare criticism, Ted Hughes, in Shakespeare and the Goddess of Complete Being, he is ostensibly a Stratfordian, and he makes valiant attempts to tie his archetypal account of the inner drama that Shakespeare is wrestling with in his view. I think it's a very, very great book. But surprise, surprise, throughout the book, the dominant symbol is the boar. The boar, starting with the boar in Venus and Adonis, but appearing as a mythic symbol and as a subtle form of allusion in play after play after play. So again, we Oxfordians can do things with these kinds of things, but nevertheless, both of them are ostensibly Stratfordians. So is René Girard in The Theatre of Envy, which is a different account of the Greek concept of mimesis from the one that Hamlet is preoccupied with. So we can get, both sides can get so engrossed in their particular positions and presuppositions that they can't look up. We can't look up. And then, of course, we get into the usual thing so familiar from politics and religion, when the two sides simply talk past one another. Now, I want to move us towards the third position, which I think is implicit in Hamlet's As 'Twere. And I want us to see that the relationship between art and life is a mixed one. There is no neat demarcation between art and life. Right, a little illustration of the background concept of this to amuse you, but it also has a serious point. These are two British advertisements can you help me, Earl, please? Your computer. I want to click on that one first.
I hope we can make it. We haven't logged in.
First attempt. It would have been better. Okay. All right.
Okay, we'll figure another way.
Okay, I'll have to just talk to them. It's, we must all suffer disappointments in life. Discipline, stoicism, self-restraint. Anyway, the PowerPoint will become available, and anyone, if you want to look it up as online as the Heineken Wordsworth advertisement, and you'll find it on YouTube. And what happens in it is that, and it's from the mid-80s, but it still relates to a nostalgic relationship to the past. It's not a postmodern advert, although it's a parody and a pastiche. And in the, we hear the strains of the climactic part of Nimrod from Elgar's Enigma Variations slowly emerging. And there we see Wordsworth wandering around amidst trees, and he's saying to himself, I wandered about all by myself. And then he shakes his head and he says, oh no, that'll never do. And then he says, I wandered about without anyone else. Oh no, no. And then, as Nimrod reaches its climax, he looks up at the clouds, and we see the clouds, and he says, I wandered lonely as a cloud, etc. And it's brilliantly done. It's very respectful to the original. Now, you have to understand, those of you that are not from the other side of the pond, that the Heineken adverts always had a punchline, and the punchline was, Heineken reaches the parts that other beers cannot reach. So it then became a theme and variations like the Enigma. And it became in this one, so you'll see, Heineken reaches the poets that other beers cannot reach. However, it's very traditional. And I wish I could have shown you the contrast. The Guinness advert, after 11 years of Margaret Thatcher and just about to embark on a similar number of Tony Blair, is a completely postmodern advert. You look for a meaning in it. It's a dancing man, and he's dancing around to a very rhythmic theme. Do 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 do, etc. And there's a barman, a very Irish-looking barman, shrugging his shoulders at the antics of this man. And sometimes the Guinness glass is that high, and sometimes it's that high. And he's very perplexed. And eventually he comes up to the barman, and the barman puts his hand on his shoulder and tells him to go back. And then suddenly, amazingly, the Guinness glass becomes life-size and he lifts it to his lips. And it's something, the punchline is something like, Guinness comes to those who wait. I can't remember exactly what it is. But it's meaningless, so we've got 5 minutes, okay. I might go on a little longer. Yes, I know. I'm trying to give us time for questions. But anyway, let's see how we go. So it's a postmodern advert. It's well worth looking up. Once again, if you want to look it up, Google YouTube Guinness advert, The Dancing Man. You'll find it. So the point of this contrast is that in 10 years or so, the genre, if you like, the artistic genre and texture of the time has completely changed. It's no longer possible in the Britain of the 90s to make an advert which has the kind of solemn and serious reference to the past that was still possible in the Wordsworth Heineken advert. Now, historicity in this sense, once you start thinking about it, you realize that a whole mass of things imply this concept. For example, I make a lot of fuss about a concept of T.S. Eliot's called the dissociation of sensibility, which those of you of a literary background will know of. The hiatus between approximately 1660 through to the Romantic period of the capacity to portray dramatic process in poetry. T.S. Eliot says that the 17th century poets like Donne and Marvell were the successors of the dramatists of the 16th century. And of course, Shakespeare is the supreme inactive writer. And by the 18th century, if you read Samuel Johnson, you'll realize that the grasp of that kind of inactivity has been lost. So there's a shift in the historical timbre or texture of the time. And it's very profound, it encompasses everything. My old teacher, F.R. Leavis, could date, you could give him any text of English from about 1500 through to 1960, and he could date it to within 5 years. But the other way you can get to think about it is just look at architecture. You immediately recognize the difference between, say, 19th century architecture and 1950s architecture. The difference in tower blocks built in the 19th century and tower blocks built in the mid-20th, post-war, post-Second World War. And that is implicit in all great criticism, but it's also, criticism is the way in which this is most profoundly appreciated. Quick illustration from Jane Austen to bring out the relationship between fiction and reality. John Henry Newman, again, I would have read this out, and I can't give you the whole of it. John Henry Newman, in about 1837, wrote about Jane Austen. He'd been reading her novels, but particularly Emma. And he said he's irritated with Jane Austen because she introduces overly little incidents into her novels. Of course, for some of us, that's the charm. But I like Emma. Whenever I think of Emma, I feel kind towards her. That Fairfax woman is a dolt, but I like Emma. Now, how is it we can develop passion, and we do feel passion, for beings who have no existence out of the realm of fiction? For me, Cordelia is one of the most profoundly moving characters who's haunted me ever since I read King Lear in my mid-teens. Those of you that know Wagner's Ring, the character of Wotan is quite extraordinarily powerful and compelling. But this is all fiction. How is this possible? It's possible because we live in two worlds simultaneously. We both live in a fictional world and an actual world. And the interrelationship between them, as the postmodernists have tried to teach us, is quite inextricable. That is the third position. That is the as 'twere. Peggy Ashcroft was once interviewed, Dame Peggy Ashcroft was once interviewed by a BBC interviewer, and she was challenged to say that art mirrored reality, and the interviewer quoted Hamlet, holds the mirror up to nature. And she corrected him and she said, as 'twere the mirror up to nature. And she totally understood, as any great actor understands, as any great writer understands, that a transmutation occurs when you take someone into the realm of the possible and out of the realm of documentary. There's Hamlet again. Well, I've talked about Wilson Knight, Girard, Hughes. I could go on about Harold Bloom, but I don't need to. And I could go on about Coleridge, as you know, but I don't need to. I went on enough about him in previous years. So this little dance that we're having is also literary criticism. we are text and not just reality. What's going on between us, whatever it is in each of your minds and your processes, is literary criticism. We need the wider concept. And, once again, I'm missing my pieces of paper, that finally, I have to inform you, I have Shakespeare on my side. So you can't argue. You can't. In the defense of poetry, Sir Philip Sidney talks about a situation where at one moment a piece of scenery is a rock, and then we're supposed to consider it a battlefield. And then we see four men come onto the stage with swords, and this is a battle, and so on and so forth. Now, if you read the choruses of the prologue of Henry V and the chorus to the act, which I think is the fourth, that ends up with the Battle of Agincourt, you will find that Shakespeare, whoever he is taking the mickey out of Sir Philip Sidney's positivism and literalism. He is saying this is an imaginative enterprise. He's not saying it doesn't relate to the real world, because he wants to talk about, imagine that you are thinking about two mighty monarchies. Those monarchies were perfectly real, but we experience them in the stage situation through our imaginations. And once we can do that, we're free to play. I'm not challenging any of the research, the magnificent research that is being done by Oxfordians and other authorship skeptics. Nor am I challenging the best research that Stratfordians do. What I am saying is that it opens doors for us if we also do literary criticism. Now, I do notice that there's an increasing amount of literary criticism going on amongst Oxfordians. The great editions of the plays that are coming out is one example of this. Roger is going to talk to us about Pericles and theology. That sounds like literary criticism to me. And so it goes on. There's a lot of examples. Earle's work on the relationship to the Greeks is obviously literary critical work and very important, and so on and on. But if we actually combine our researches with literary criticism, then we can do things like think about the parallels between what Eddie Jolly is showing and talked about yesterday at First Presbyterian Church in relation to showing the development of Shakespeare's art through the three versions of Hamlet that we have. And if we then think about either D.H. Lawrence or Jane Austen, then what we find with Lawrence is that he nearly always writes at least three or two, and sometimes more, versions of any novel. In other words, he's developing his writing all the time. And it seems to me clear and obvious that Shakespeare was that kind of writer, just as, again, Jane Austen was. There's a magnificent, on the online version of the Cambridge Journal Scrutiny, you will find three papers by Mrs. Leavis on a critical theory of Jane Austen's writings. And she makes a remark, amongst other things, it does not become criticism to cry inspiration and then kneel down and pray. I'm going to pass on and not worry about history versus science, but that'll be available in the published version, as it were. And that's my final point. We should welcome it. How long have I got?
Questions, anybody?
Well, thanks, Stuart. That was fantastic. Really interesting. Yeah. Can you just explain what reflexive engagement is rather than reflective engagement?
Yes. If we go back to the choruses of Henry V, when the prologue, for example, calls attention over a muse of fire, etc., etc., and then he says that pardon gentles all, and he comes back to himself. Now that flip over between the actuality that is going on the stage and the imaginative enterprise of the creation of the play is the kind of thing I'm talking about. Of course, it's been carried to great extremes in modern drama. Pirandello's Six Characters in Search of an Author is a classic example of it, but most modern drama now is experimental drama in some way or other. And likewise, clearly, Hamlet is playing with that juxtaposition in the play within the play. So there's an implicit commentary in the fact that Hamlet, the man on the stage, introduces a play within a play, and of course the implicit commentary is on the authorial function of the writer who's producing the play called Hamlet. And once you start to think in that way, you get an infinite reflexive loop, and once you get that, it seems to me you've broken the hold of naive realism in the classical sense, the idea that there's the world out there and the work of art or the piece of philosophy or the bit of science or the bit of history in here, and they have to correspond. Rather, there's that spiraling looping. Is that an answer? There you are, you see, you get a dramatic enactment, which I am now exploiting to make the point.
Questions? Anybody else? Do you want to speculate on the worldwide production of Hamlet performances and readings in 2016 that I believe are being sponsored by the Shakespeare Trust, but the Shakespeare Theatre in Stratford? And what do you think is anticipated, and what you think will come out, and if it will affect Oxfordian thinking in any way?
Well, I can comment on that in one sense. What's going on in China, for example, in all of these kind of ways, is very fascinating. You're well aware that no drama plays with this reality, illusion, disjunction in a very profound way. You know, you want a mountain, so you just show it with your hand. I mean, I can't do it, but that's the kind of thing that happens in no drama. And one might say that Waiting for Godot, which just has one spiky little tree on the stage, is a piece of no drama. Now, because of their traditions, the Chinese are very much more receptive, therefore, in certain ways, to dramatic art and to literary criticism than those who are caught in this loop of Stratford, anti-Stratford, and so on. And I think one of the things, I'm involved with the Leavis Society in Great Britain, commemorating and developing the work of F.R. Leavis. The Chinese love F.R. Leavis. He's a dead as a dodo in England and probably in America as well, although he's a very great author, but he's in that period of hiatus. Not in China, because his affinity with Confucian thinking is so great, it's spreading like wildfire. And they're fascinated by it, and they're going to have a Leavis conference in Beijing next year. Now, I think, therefore, in many ways, the other countries of the world who aren't preoccupied with who wrote this damn stuff are going to be much more open-minded, and they're not going to be satisfied by being told that you're an idiot if you think this, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, they're also, if they think about the anomalies in connection with the Earl of Oxford, they're going to want answers to that kind of thing as well. So I think it will have a very powerful impact, and I think, so to say, one might say that Stratford has sown the wind, it may well reap the whirlwind.
Yes.
Hank.
Yeah, I'm not even sure how to make it a simple question, but what in your mind...
I had the same problem.
What in your mind is, how do we have to understand that change from the 19th century to mid-20th, when the author was withdrawn, the death of the author, whatever you want to call it? What's the reason in your head?
Well, I think that... I think the two, when you say the death of the author, do you mean the death of the author in the postmodern sense?
Yes.
And so on? And you don't mean the airbrushing out of
No.
Susan DeVere from the record of her paintings, the paintings of her, and all that kind of stuff?
No,
you mean the death of the author. Well, I think the death of the author, properly understood, doesn't involve a dismissal of authorship, but it involves a profound relativization of authorship. That it involves the recognition that whoever we are, in whatever situation we are caught up, if you like, in a total textual drama. I mean, just watch modern television if you don't believe that. Look at what Mr. Trump is doing. The crazy man is, as it were, completely dominating. Why? Because nobody knows what the hell to do with him. Because he's not playing by the rules. So suddenly we have this dramatic performance going on week after week, month after month, on the media, and that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. Who is the author of Mr. Trump? No, I'm serious. It's a serious question. I mean, there was a Stockhausen when, at the time of 9/11, he happened to make a remark in an interview about it, that it was great art. Now, of course, it is great art in a sense, that those images are extraordinarily compelling and powerful, and the truth of his remark will be recognized in the course of time. But just as the first tragedy ever performed in Greece, which in Athens, which recorded the defeat that Athens had suffered at the hands of the Persians the previous year, resulted in the author being driven out of Athens never to be seen again because it was too close. Likewise, what Stockhausen said was too close. And auditoriums, concert halls all over the globe cancelled his concerts. Anything that was performing his music. So that's what I'm talking about. Was Stockhausen the author of that? Was the age we're living in the author of that? Who is the author of that? It's a movable feast. That's the kind of thing I'm talking about. The 20th century grasped that. Previously, only very great individuals had grasped it, one of whom was William Shakespeare.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Perfect.
Yeah.
Great talk.
Great.
You want to answer that? Take that.
So for our next speaker, we still are inviting speakers from other lands. We have Professor John Lewis from York University of Florida, Canada, who was the host of the conference 2 years ago, and it was a very delightful thing to have.